You're listening to the Onside Podcast, the podcast for innovation-driven entrepreneurship here in Atlantic Canada. We're building a community around this kind of entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Alex McCann, and this is episode number 9. Today, our guest is Darren Rawls, the president and chief scientific officer at Sona Nanotech. A commercially minded scientist, Darren has worked in the diagnostic and nanoparticle industry for several years and continues to do so. He is a thought leader and speaks at industry seminars and conferences and has been part of the advisory board of the World Gold Council. He is passionate about science, education, corporate social responsibility, and the link between business and the community. He has led a number of civic improvement projects and mentorship programs in his native Wales and has been a Grow Movement volunteer consultant mentoring small business owners in Africa. Outside of work, Darren is an avid Welsh rugby fan and a committed family man who enjoys spending time with his wife and two young sons. Darren, so excited to have you here on our Onside Podcast and welcome to the show. We shared a little bit about your background, a little bit of a bio about you and all the interesting things that you have been up to, but there's so much more about you that's really interesting and dynamic. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about you, a little bit about your background.
Sure. Hi, Alex. Thanks very much for having me on. So my name's Darren Rawls. I'm currently the Chief Scientific Officer and President of a company called Sona Nanotech here based in Atlanta, Canada. As you can tell from my really thick Canadian accent, I'm not actually a native here. Originally, I'm from Wales in the UK, and I moved to Atlanta, Canada probably nearly 3 years ago. Well, it'll be 3 years this summer. As a slight change of pace, but also to take on the opportunity to lead a company myself from a previous role that I had in a company back in Wales. Traditionally, kind of grew up South Wales Valley boy, you know, doing a whole manner of different things, you know, always trying to find an opportunity to kind of make a small bit of money for myself so we could enjoy weekends. Ended up going to university in Cardiff, studying science, always had a huge interest in science, and then kind of got a job straight after university with the local laboratory there. Was meant to go to another university a few months later to study for a PhD, and ended up actually staying in the company for about 15 years instead. So quickly realized that a well-paid job was much better than a continuing education. But education wasn't, it's always been a passion of mine, so wasn't ever going to give it up. And after about 10 years working in the lab, quickly realized then as well that the business side of things is where you can make a real difference. You get paid more, which is great, but also it's actually where you can actually make all the decisions and make a huge difference in businesses and companies. So I quickly then went back to university, kind of like night school, doing an executive MBA to learn a lot more about the business side of things. And it took about 3.5 years to do that. And then as soon as I graduated, I already kind of started building opportunities for myself, and an opportunity came along to take over Sona. And then the rest is the last 3 years of my life been here in Atlantic Canada.
Oh, that's great. So you said you had an interest in science and went to school for science. What did you actually study in university, and how did that land you to that job you were talking about? Was it directly related?
Yeah. So I actually studied biomedical science and toxicology at university, bachelor's degree. And the job I went into, I literally, as I say, I graduated on the Friday, and found a local lab. And I literally went to the lab on the Monday, knocked on the door and said, hey, I'd like to kind of get some experience here working in an actual lab environment. I'll do everything from washing glassware to helping people make solutions, etc. I just want some summer experience, essentially. And the lab manager that was there, wonderful lady, Nikki Robinson, still a very good friend of mine. She took me around. Yeah, we had a bit of a chat and she said, look, there's a job that's just come up actually in our production team. Would you like to start? You know, would you like a job? And I was like, yeah, of course. But however, you know, by the way, I am looking to leave. I want to go and do my PhD, etc. She's like, yeah, no problem. We'll see how you go. And then a few months later, I knocked back on her office door and said, by the way, yeah, I'd like to stay if that's okay. And she was like, yep, you're here, no problem. So yeah, as I say, 15 years later, I stayed. And it was great because I was able to get into that job. And work my kind of way through that company. It was a very small company. It was about 30 people when I started. By the time I left, it was about 500. It was a very ambitious company. Mm-hmm. You know, they went through a lot of growth, which was fantastic. And even part of that growth, you know, they ended up, you know, being privately owned, and then they floated on the stock market for 3 years, AIM 250, and then they had an exit with a big buyer in the US. So again, I was present for that, and I got an opportunity to learn a lot from, you know, some of the executives and the management team there as I grew. So you know, very grateful for that experience, you know, through those 15 years for sure.
So it sounds like you had a really sort of entrepreneurial kind of mindset from the beginning, even just get it going out and trying to find that first job. It doesn't sound like you waited around and, you know, tried to put out a whole bunch of resumes. You just sort of went out and started knocking on the door. So that's pretty impressive, and obviously led you down a really interesting path with your previous company. And it sounds like they went from a really not small, but a growing sort of cycle that led them to an exciting exit. So you got some experience, great experience with your former work in Wales. So how did you kind of end up in Atlantic Canada? How did you come across the pond, as it were?
Yeah, so just with regards to getting that opportunity with that previous company, rather than take the kind of guess standard approach around putting out resumes and stuff, I did that as well. Don't get me wrong. But I think I've always had it in me to kind of, as I say, try and make the best of a situation and look for an opportunity to do things slightly differently, which sometimes more than likely tends to give you an edge over anybody else. You know, trying to find those opportunities and when they exist. And I think that's kind of almost like partly a bit of a trait of an entrepreneur, is they can look at the landscape slightly differently, see what everybody else is doing and saying, okay, how can I do that different and still make it work? So I've kind of taken that approach pretty much most of my life. You know, everything from when I was a small child, looking at an opportunities in schools and, you know, kind of local businesses and trying how to, as I mentioned earlier, kind of how I can potentially try and earn a few dollars for the weekends fun. But in terms of actually getting here, part of my previous job, I had opportunities to travel a lot and go to different conferences. Came across the technology of Sona Nanotech at a conference. It was being presented by the founders, you know, kind of at a research-based conference. And I managed to get to speak to the team there. And I thought, wow, this is some really exciting technology. I don't think they really knew what they had. They certainly knew what they had from a science perspective, but in terms of executing it and putting it into a business opportunity and what area to go into, it was a bit uncertain. They at the time was kind of had a plan just to take the material and offer it as a reagent, you know, as a solution, essentially, you know, something you can buy for other researchers. But that has a limit in terms of growing as a business. So kind of got speaking to them about it and said, look, hey, you know, I was learning all these kind of things around business and my MBA, etc. So just started chatting to them and offering them, you know, some advice and help, really, if they wanted to take it. You know, I never said I was right or wrong, but we kind of got a friendship going and also, like I said, offering some advisory services and explained to them about the diagnostic market and what I knew about it. And then they, you know, the venture capital group, which are based in Halifax here, they kind of heard about kind of what we were doing. So they offered me to come over and explain to them. So I did that and literally kind of mapped out a business plan on the back of an envelope. You know, the chairman of that group took me down to his cottage and we kind of got chatting and ended up putting up a fence around one of his orchards, you know, and then sitting on his dock with a beer and he offered me an opportunity I couldn't really turn down. And he said, look, you know, the team here needs some direction from a management leadership perspective. You know this industry, so we'd like to offer you the position as a CEO. And, you know, it's not every day that you get offered the chance to become a CEO. And certainly from a young boy from, you know, a valley town in South Wales, you know, I don't think I ever had that dream to become a CEO of a company, but, you know, opportunities come by and I think you've got to kind of take them as and when you can. I was really lucky to have that opportunity. And my wife, she's a graphic designer and she was working from home. She was a freelancer. So we kind of had loose ties to where we were. So we were able to be flexible and, you know, make a decision around making the change. We had two young children that could quite easily adapt to a change in environment. So we kind of took the plunge and made decision. It took us about 9 months to get here, actually. By the time we did everything around immigration, work permits, and finding a house, which was very important for us, a house in the right area for different schools, etc., and getting to learn more about Halifax and the surrounding area. So we moved here August 2018, and we haven't looked back. You know, it's been amazing.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I love hearing people's journeys of how they end up here in Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada. It's something that's near and dear to my heart because I'm also an immigrant. So everyone's got an interesting immigrant story. So tell me a little bit about Sona Nanotech. What kind of company is Sona Nanotech? And tell us a little bit about the name as well, because I think there's something neat about the name for Sona Nanotech.
Yeah, so Sona actually means gold in Hindi. And Sona's technology is based on gold nanorod particle technology. So it's a nanotechnology. We create particles that are rod-shaped and they're gold-based. And one of the founders, Dr. Kalbir Singh, is a Hindi native, from India, so another immigrant that came here to do his postdoc at Sanifex University up in Anaganish. And that's where he founded the company with the professor there as well. And he came up with the name, Sona. And typically in the biotech industry, when you go to these conferences, again, other companies, their branding is all white and particularly one the primary color, like white and red or white and blue, white and teal, et cetera. They came in and they were black and yellow. And it kind of helped them stand out a little bit. So I was a bit like, wow, okay. And then I spoke to Colby and I said, so where did you come up with the name Sona? And he said, oh, it means gold in Hindi. And I was like, wow, that's fantastic. What an excellent origin story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and help with the brand. And as I say, wife being a graphic designer, she could jump on that for sure and help cement that brand. And we could take it from there, really. So another advantage around it. Mm. But Sona itself as a company, as I mentioned, we're a life sciences, biotechnology, nanotechnology company. We take our nanorods as the base and we can apply them in various different areas. The primary objective area that we're focusing on, certainly in the short to midterm, is the diagnostic space. I think over the last 18 months, everybody's familiar probably now, has become familiar certainly with lateral flow assays. Little tests that are similar to pregnancy tests, but obviously COVID-19 hitting. Mm-hmm. It was certainly a quick race to kind of develop those tests and get those tests to market, for looking at antibodies and antigens. So we had kind of just come out of a program of work around, developing our technology. We'd spent 18 months prior to kind of the back end of 2019. We'd spent about 18 months developing our nanorods to really get them to a place where we could produce them and scale them properly, robustly, and put them into these diagnostic tests. And we worked with a number of partners to validate and facilitate that in various different guises, so whether it's tests for foodborne pathogens, tests for health and wellness markers, different tests for fungi and bacteria, those types of things. So we spent a good while, and then towards the end of 2019, we kind of sat down and said, right, okay, where are the areas we want to kind of move towards and put our technology into different tests? And again, slightly serendipitously, but then also whenever anything is serendipitous, I think as an entrepreneur, you've got to look at it and say, well, okay, how can I take advantage of that opportunity? And I hate the words advantage and exploitation. so I say them with the nicest possible way. But you look at it and say, okay, where can we find a space? And, COVID was starting to hit. I had a friend of mine literally just moved from Beijing to Wuhan 2 weeks prior to the outbreak being announced.
Wow.
So I was chatting to him over the Christmas and New Year, and he was telling me what was going on, keeping me up to date. And, we kind of had a discussion about it. And I said, look, if this explodes out of China and it starts going rampant, the world is going to need rapid antigen tests or some form of test that's going to be able to determine whether people have infected or not. Mm-hmm. So we kind of, internally here, we started developing a plan of action. We got in contact with a few people in our network that were working on these things or that were keen to work with us as well and could see the spot and see the opportunity. So we quickly pulled a network of groups together and started developing a test essentially for COVID. And we've probably spent the last 18 months now developing those tests. So initially we started developing a test that can be used with a nasopharyngeal swab, you know, the one that goes and tickles the back of your brain. You know, because
I know those.
I'm sure everyone knows those.
They're lovely. Yeah.
I've never heard anybody say they're lovely, but certainly necessity, I guess. But definitely, we spent a lot of time developing that, and that went to market at the back end of last year in Europe and in any area that takes the CE mark. And then since then, we've been kind of utilizing that base platform and, again, forward thinking, looking at where the market's going. As you've just said, you know, everybody loves those tests. And and we're like, well, actually, you know, there's probably a better alternative out there. And where does that sit? And, you know, thought patterns and some research and stuff coming out showing that saliva is a potential opportunity as well. And there was a group up at Ottawa University that approached us and said, look, you know, we're doing some work on saliva here for PCR-based tests. And you know, is it translatable to a rapid antigen test? And so we've kind of spent the last probably 3 or 4 months adapting our current platform to work with saliva. And we've now got a saliva-based test that's currently in clinical studies ongoing in Toronto. Great. And other areas around the world as well. You know, other partners kind of just assessing our test for us. And then hopefully we can bring that to market pretty quickly and pretty soon. And it becomes a bit of a less non-invasive test for everybody and much more acceptable.
Well, I was going to say, I know my son will appreciate that because we had to, I think he was going to go do some sports or something like that. And we had to go get the nasal swab test. And when we got to the place, he was expecting to do the saliva-based test and was not lucky enough to do it. So I'm sure that there'll be a lot of people who would really appreciate having an alternative that works well.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I've got 2 young sons myself, and they definitely prefer doing a saliva-based test. For, you know, and again, it's kind of just that feedback from talking to different people and seeing that opportunity is, you know, kind of, you know, pushed us in that direction. As I say, hopefully we can bring that to bear. But, you know, that's not all we do. I mean, as I mentioned, that's kind of short-term areas of diagnostics, and COVID was the primary area for us to focus on. But there is life after COVID. You know, I think we can all see that on the horizon. There's still some challenges to go, I'm sure, you know, across the world, but we can all see the light at the end of the tunnel, I think.
Yeah.
So there is life after that, and also life ongoing around it as well. And so there are other tests that we want to look at and develop. And 2 of those areas, one we're looking at is a concussion biomarker test to determine if someone's had a fall or if you got hit on the, you know, if you took a bit of a hit in a ice hockey game or a rugby game or something, then, you know, you can do a quick test at the side of a field or a rink, you know, within 15, 20 minutes and determine whether someone's, you know, there's a marker now present in their blood that's potentially going to lead them to have a concussion. And then obviously you can take the appropriate steps to mitigate against that. So basically don't send your child back out onto the field or something is the essential part of it. Or, you know, obviously, you know, if you're an elderly patient in a care home or something, or if you've been in a traffic accident, you know, again, the right precautions can be taken around that individual.
Yeah.
So that's an exciting area for us that we're about to kick off a project on that. Another one is looking at completely flip side, different side, is looking at detection of tuberculosis in cows, so bovine TB. And again, we've built a consortium probably over the last 12, 18 months together with a group in the UK. And actually this morning, we've just been awarded some funding from National Research Council for nearly $500,000.
Oh, wow. You know, congratulations.
Thank you. yeah, so that's exciting. And that project will kick off. We've been doing some work on that as a group anyway in the background the last few months, but that's now become a formal project for us as a result of that funding. So again, you know, it kind of lends to the ecosystem of startups and helping kind of new companies, certainly a great support network here and opportunities to access that type of funding. You know, and beyond that, there's another whole realm that we want to get into, which is utilizing our nanorods for in vivo technology, which is basically looking and detecting things within the body, within the cell. So, you know, these particles are certainly akin and, you know, you're able to use them for everything from cell imaging to potentially, you know, photothermal therapy and cancer diagnostics. You know, so that's a 5-10 year plan that we need to put in place. Well, we're putting in place, and we've certainly got a few irons in the fire around those areas ongoing. Hopefully we can bring that to bear in the medium to long term.
And I mean, I'm just so impressed with this and all of the things that Sona Nanotech is doing, from the things that you're doing around tests for COVID, obviously very topical for where we are right now and probably where we'll be for a while, especially, you know, all over the world. Your concussion diagnostic is also really interesting as well. You know, here in Canada, we love our hockey, lots of concussions. I'm sure in Wales, you love your rugby and, you know, other such sports. So that's really interesting. And it sounds like, you know, you have many different avenues that you're pursuing. You know, as a, I guess I would say, a relatively youngish company, and with such a, you know, shifting landscape that is happening around us, whether it's because of COVID or just new opportunities or new research on the horizon, how do you kind of stay grounded and make decisions as a, you know, CEO in a very changing, rapidly evolving, you know, landscape around you? How do you do that? What are some of the, maybe there's some people out there like, well, I want to know some tips or tricks, but is there something that you do or think of, or how do you navigate that?
That's a great question. I think for myself personally, I've always had a conviction around, certainly in the diagnostic space, that I'd love to see these types of tests in people's homes on a regular basis, you know, and that's always kind of like a vision that I've set for myself to try and obtain, whether it's through one company, whether it's through five different companies that I might have to go through. That's kind of something that I set out for myself probably about 10 years ago. I could see it and I was thinking, right, this is beyond pregnancy tests. You know, what else can other people do in their homes? And I could see that the landscape was shifting towards that. And I think certainly with COVID happening, that certainly accelerated that progress in the last probably 18 months, 2 years, and will certainly accelerate it as we continue forward. So having conviction in a thought pattern or an idea and believing in that, you'll have your non-believers always, right? There will always be naysayers, and probably more naysayers than believers to start with. But that's kind of, I think, one of the traits and one of the roles of a leader, of a CEO, a chief scientific officer, however you want to see them, is they have a thought pattern, they have an idea and a conviction. And it's about not convincing other people that they're right, but it's more about just sharing the thoughts and ideas with them around it and showing that you're passionate around it and that you're trying your best to make that happen and make a difference. And not every idea you have will be the correct one either. You've got to be quite resilient. You've got to be able to accept a no, you know, and you'll get a million no's and before you get one yes. And anybody that's set up any kind of company or been involved in sales, even, you know, you just talk to any salesperson and they'll tell you exactly the same thing. And I think that's why, you know, a lot of salespeople do go on and set up their own companies, because they've built that resilience over years. And I've been no different. I've not been in sales directly. I've supported sales teams over the years, but I've been in sales in terms of trying to grow a business and grow departments within companies and pitching and selling ideas to your bosses and colleagues and different things, everything to do with the business, or even trying to do new things outside of the business to enhance it a little bit. And again, you don't always win those arguments or those decisions. It's different if you can make the decision yourself. It's much easier. So I think that's part of the reason why a lot of people go, oh, you know, I'm going to go do this myself now, because then I can make a decision. But then honestly, you do that and you're responsible for everything. And then you quickly find out, actually, I can't make this decision on my own. You know, I don't know enough. So what you end up then doing is surrounding yourself with other people. And that's certainly one of the approaches I've taken at Sona. I knew probably after about 12 months coming into this, I wasn't going to be able to do everything I wanted to do myself. And even within that 12 months, I had a massive steep learning curve. I literally came in and we had to secure the business from a financial perspective. And we took it, you know, as part of that, we made a decision to take it onto the public market so we could raise capital for it. And I've never done anything like that before. I'd been involved in a company that's gone through it. I was never involved in actually doing any of the work. So again, luckily, you know, surrounded by some fantastic people that had that knowledge and experience and being able to do it. And we've continued on that trait, you know. So probably the middle of last year, I'd realized that as we started to grow as a business, more in the public domain, I knew that that wasn't an area of my knowledge and expertise as much as other people. There's probably other people out there that could do it better that had that experience. So we brought in people to do that. We brought in a new CEO with that public markets knowledge experience, to really kind of be the public face of the business type of things, and allows me then to kind of take a sidestep and concentrate on the science, which is what I was passionate about and which is why I got into this. Alongside that, then we also brought in, experts in supply chain, experts in commercial opportunities within this space, as well as building the team from the ground up as well, adding in more technical-based scientists that had different skill sets to what I'd built over the years. So it's something that I've learned from other entrepreneurs, whether they're your Elon Musk's or your Steve Jobs or your Richard Branson's. They're all the big names that everybody knows about. But there's lots of others out there that I'm quite admirable about and the way that they've approached it. But they all take the same approach, which is about bringing in people around you that have skill sets that you certainly don't have, and then getting out their way. letting them make a decision and do a job.
I'm still working on that. My team at OnSide, they really support me. I'm trying to get out of the way, but still have more to learn on that one. So I appreciate that.
It can be difficult, but it's, as long as you give them the accountability that comes with it as well. That's certainly one of my tips that I would suggest is bringing people to make sure that they're accountable.
Sona Nanotech has been rapidly growing and adapting, during COVID, and you're pursuing kind of new paths of opportunity and research. And these are really great things. I'm kind of curious because the company is based here in Halifax, its own kind of growing startup community. And I'm just wondering, how you're finding it here, what our startup community is like, and how have you found the ecosystem that's here, and how does it work for Sona Nanotech to be based here?
Well, when I kind of first looked at the opportunity of Sona, and the company at the time was based up in Anaganish. Prior to that, it spent 12 months in the Vacheron Center up in Cape Breton, where they'd had funding put into that. But then they'd spent a year there and they moved back out and kind of were based back at the university. So then the decision was quickly made to move it to Halifax, and we talked to the founders about that and the benefits of doing so, A, from a logistics perspective, but B, also the network and the support network that Halifax had to offer. And even then, just 3 years ago, it's moved on so much since then to where it is now. I mean, whether that comes with a level of awareness from myself, who obviously is new to the space, but certainly in the last 3 years, you've seen new kind of startup networks and kind of funds come to life. The group down at Volta, for example, they weren't here when I first started, or certainly not in the guise they are now. We were lucky enough to find a really, really good support network through Innova Corp, essentially who supported us. Typically, they would invest in companies, but our company was already on the public market. So we just needed space and access to potential, network of mentors and, other services, etc. So we had a chat with them and they were great and they provided us with some space over in the Bays department over in Dartmouth, which has been our home. Mm-hmm. We quickly moved in there and built a lab there. And once you're there, you're in that kind of community startup space that you can talk to other CEOs and other CFOs and also, other staff members from other companies. And there's probably 7 or 8 companies within that space. And we've made some great relationships with some of the other groups that are there. Yeah. So I think it's certainly evolving and it continues to evolve in the space around here, because we were already a publicly listed company. Access to further funding and programs and funds probably wasn't that relevant to us, to where we were, apart from, we could go and talk to like National Research Council for new R&D projects or ACOA for business, for, low interest business loans, etc., for growth and capital, which was great. And it's fantastic to have access to those services. But from a real kind of, seed ground startup perspective, there are other services out there that anybody new starting a business can certainly access through Nova Scotia Business Institute and the guys at Innova Corp, etc. So I think there's a growing economy for sure. I think it can certainly continue to be added to. you know, there's a growing sector around venture capitalism and angel investors that are starting to come to Halifax, which again can only help support and grow new businesses. So I think we're all on the right tracks and the right roads. You know, we started that journey. We're still very, very early in that journey, but the seeds are being planted for it. And hopefully in the next 5-10 years, we'll see that continue to grow. And again, I you know, and I'm happy to be part of that, and you look forward to continue to be part of that.
I think that's a really good overview of kind of our ecosystem and kind of how things are growing and some of the support networks that are here. I'm curious, just if you, you know, as a as an entrepreneur and a business leader here, especially in the life sciences sector in this region, if you could have like a magic wand and say, abracadabra, make this thing happen or amplify this aspect, is there something that you think could really sort of propel things forward for the startup kind of community here or ecosystem that's developing here?
Yeah, that's a, again, a really good question. I think certainly some, for me, startups and entrepreneurship is very much a big thing around it is networks and building those networks and relationships. That's pretty tricky at this point in time with all the lockdowns and everything. But even prior to that, as I mentioned, a lot of the things that we did, certainly within our business and our space, was we went to established conferences within our sector, but they all tended to be outside of Canada, predominantly in the US and in Europe, and they, and you know, and those, you know, those conferences etc. have been kind of established for a long time, but I don't see a ton of them happening here in you know, certainly in Halifax, in Atlantic Canada. I mean, I go down to Boston and MIT, and there's literally a conference every day. There's probably three going on every day, whereas here, you know, I'd walk through the Marriott Hotel down on the harbourfront sometimes, and there'd be conferences going on there. Or we've got the new Halifax Convention Centre, a great opportunity to hold more conferences. So I think it's kind of, with, certainly within the life sciences and you know, the biotech industry, maybe trying to establish, you know, Halifax as a go-to destination for those types of conferences. I mean, we're starting to build travel connections to Europe and certainly across Canada and the US, especially on the East Coast. You know, there's definitely opportunity and space within calendars to be able to kind of build those events. And it's at those events that you, you know, that you meet and grow those networks within your specific niche industry.
Right.
You know, even if you want to hold general entrepreneurial type events and coaching, et cetera. You know, so I think it's those types of things I would probably wave my magic wand around and see if we can do more of that. You know, I do.
Those are good. Those are really good suggestions. And you're right. We have our brand new Halifax Convention Center right downtown. The downtown area is hustling and bustling usually when we can all get out. And I actually can't wait for vaccines to increase and for all of those things to kind of happen so we can sort of get back to some of the normal things. I definitely think that that is a really good suggestion. We'll see what we can do to you know, get some magic going here. That's a really great idea. I have just a couple more questions. One of the things we had been talking about earlier, and you were talking about the journey for Sona Nanotech, and we are looking around our ecosystem here in the region and seeing that things are growing. We've had some really interesting exits from different companies like Verafin that was huge and things like that. And we like to celebrate all of the wonderful things. But, you know, sometimes, you know, when you're doing a startup, things don't always work out for the best. And sometimes things just don't happen the way you want. And you talked a lot during our conversation kind of about your resiliency muscle and, you know, how you've had to try things and go back and forth and go back to the drawing board as necessary. You know, what do you think is needed around, you know, this idea of failure and risk-taking? Is there something you think about when you think about this idea of startups and failure and how we kind of deal with some of those challenging aspects of being an entrepreneur and things not working out?
Yeah, I think failure is a natural course of any startup and anybody going into creating a new startup or joining a new startup, even as an employee of a startup. You know, you, certainly if being a new employee, and I don't want to scare anybody, but if you're joining a new startup, you don't think that you're going to have a job for life, because probably 8 times out of 10, that startup might not be around the next 12 months or 2 years later. But again, that's not but by joining a new startup, you get the opportunity to forge it and help it grow. But I think the failure aspect, I think you've got to go into it with an open mind, with almost an expectation that, yes, we've got the drive, we want to make this work, we're confident it's going to work, but also with an air of kind of skepticism and say, well, okay, is this likely to work? And then start questioning yourself around it and trying to block off any gaps that you may identify or those risks, essentially, and saying, how do I mitigate against those? And you're never going to mitigate against everything. Mm. So you just look at the ones that are really polarizing and say, yeah, if that happens, that is not going to work for us and we're going to be out. So I think you've got to look at it with a pragmatic mind as well. And a lot of entrepreneurs, me included, don't have that. Don't have that mindset. We don't go in and say, oh yeah, because this is your passion. So you're like, you want this to work.
Yeah.
So again, it comes back to around surrounding yourself with other people who are going to question you. As much as you want to be surrounded with people who agree with you and say yes to everything that you want to do, and you do need those people that'll push back against you somewhat and say, yeah, I don't think you're right this time.
Yeah.
But long as they can offer an opinion and reasoning behind it, that's fair enough. You don't want them to disagree just for disagreeing.
Yeah.
So those failures are inevitable. And when they happen, and they will happen, people can get lauded for it and really kind of put down on. And it can really demoralize them a lot and maybe even break their spirit as to not want to do it again. Mm. But I don't think people should look at it that way. There's certainly the last couple of years, there's a whole thing around, if you're going to fail, fail fast.
Mm.
I don't really agree with that, because sometimes by doing things fast is why you end up failing.
Mm.
If you need the time to kind of build your idea and grow your business and your plan, then take that time, but still have a level of expectation that, hey, look, I could fail this in 6 months and then we're out. Okay, great, brilliant. But what I really want is to give this the best opportunity to grow. I need 2 or 3 years, and then I'll fail. And then if it fails after 2 or 3 years, look at it and say, well, okay. Rather than, yeah, great, that failed, what the hell do I do now? It's more look at it and say, as you're going, oh, this potentially may be on a road to failing. Can I move? Can I shift? Can I pivot while it's kind of maybe on a downward trajectory to kind of help bring it back up? Or even if you can't salvage in that way, at least look at it at the back end and say, okay, what did I learn from that? And take it as an experience, take it as a learning experience. So I don't see failures as outright things that you can not learn from. Probably you can learn a lot more from failures than you can wins. As you say, you win and everybody celebrates it. You lose and everybody vilifies you.
Mm.
Whereas I don't think you should be vilified for it. You should, unless you've done something, particularly
naughty.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
But I don't think, I think I could probably be pretty confident in saying that most people that are going into starting up their businesses, either on their own or with partners, aren't going into it to do something naughty as such. They're trying to do it to make it work. They want to try and make a difference. So if it doesn't happen, it's people's time, energy, effort, money. I think that's the biggest part of it, is people get lauded for failing because at some point, somewhere, someone's lost money. But that's part of the risk of when you're investing into a new startup, whether you're an angel investor, whether you're a VC, whether you're a government-funded agency, whether you're an investor on a public stock market, whatever. Those investments into companies, whether you're big or small, are all risk-based. So it's up to individuals then to accept that risk that whatever money they're putting in, they might not see come out at the back end. But, and I think that's what, because then when people lose money, people get, they look for someone to blame, I guess. And it's always the people who started the company are the ones that get blamed.
It's like a double-edged sword. Yeah. People want entrepreneurs to be successful and take all the risk and do all the work. And then, but they also don't want them to fail.
Absolutely.
It's a really hard, it's a really hard path.
Yeah.
I have one quick little question, maybe,
sure.
And then I have another little question, because I know you have some passions around community and some work and things that you're interested in. So I want to highlight some of those. But I have a quick question that we ask all of our guests on the Onside podcast, because we're all about trying to celebrate entrepreneurs and people on this journey and really looking at innovation-driven entrepreneurship in particular, not exclusively, but really trying to get at what that is. So we usually ask our guests, and if you could like think about it, what does innovation-driven entrepreneurship mean to you? Like, what is it?
So I think, you know, the word innovation, the word entrepreneurship, they seem to be certainly buzzwords of the last probably 5-10 years. And I actually, when I was doing my MBA, I actually did my dissertation on strategy, growth, and how innovation drives that, and used companies as case studies to showcase that. Innovation is, you know, we used to talk about it as a innovation with a little I or innovation with a big I. You can have both types. Innovation with a big I tends to be the grand big new ideas. So, you know, the most prominent one probably in everybody's mind at the moment is, you know, electronic vehicles. You know, so you look at Tesla, for example, and you know, the way they're disrupting that industry by doing something different. And it's so much more than just building an electric car. There's a whole ton of stuff that comes with that as well, around you know, infrastructure, as well as then autonomous vehicles, etc. So that's innovation with a big I, and that certainly drives entrepreneurship and industries forward, because they're the new things that are coming out that people, you know, want to be part of for whatever reason. So, you know, so innovation with a big I for certainly is driving it, but then also innovation with a little I, which can be innovation internally within a business. You know, can you do something a better way? You know, maybe it's a production process. Whether it's is it a way we look at how we onboard people into a new business, for example, or how we treat them. You know, do we look at slightly different benefits packages? Even here, when I first came here, I came from a UK lifestyle and a UK companies where it's pretty standard to have, you know, 4 weeks. Annual leave, you know, during the year, as well as all statutory holidays. I came here and I was, someone told me, they're like, oh yeah, we get like 10 days annual leave, as well as all the statutory holidays, but we get 10 days annual leave. And I was like, that's different to what I'm used to. Mm. So I made it as a bit of a mandate, even in Sono, was, well, we're going to do that slightly differently. We're going to be innovative as a company and offer, you know, just offer something different to our employees, you know, and just a small change. And that was a way of, we were able to attract people to the business quite quickly and quite easily, because it was a USP that we were offering as a business that was different to other companies that these people may have gone to. Mm. You know, it's just small little things like that. So again, it's, for me, innovation-driven entrepreneurship. It doesn't have to be this massive, huge idea that's going to change the world. More than likely, it's probably just finding slightly smaller, different ways to how you can put yourself ahead of, say, maybe other competitors, or looking at a different way of doing something that's, you know, just going to put you in a league of your own, essentially. Mm. Or even then, like I say, even in just internally making small improvements, continuous improvements within businesses. A couple of years ago, the British cycling team, probably 10 years ago, actually, after the Olympics, the British cycling team made a conscious decision, you know, to start doing small innovations in their training, in their bikes, in their recruitment of riders, everything, you know, just tiny little iterations each time that they looked at something. And what they did was look at probably 20 different areas and made small, tiny little inroads and steps of continuous improvement in each of those areas. And on their own as individuals, they don't really make a huge ton of difference. But when you add them all up, it put them over the edge and gave them the edge, and then ended up, you know, fostering Tour de France winners for probably 5 out of the last 7 years. You know, they won pretty much everything in the Olympics in London, 2012 and 2016, you know, in cycling. That's so amazing. It's, you know, those types of that type of innovation is what I feel is innovation-driven entrepreneurship.
Okay, I like it. I think that's very useful, because sometimes people think, oh man, I have to like invent some totally new technology or things like that. So there's this idea that there's kind of two ways to think about innovation. One could be, obviously, yes, coming up with a completely novel solution to a problem that's out there that involves some level of technology, et cetera. And then there's also the little I innovation that you're talking about, which allows people to, you know, make some improvements, try things a different way. So, and that might be a little bit more accessible to the everyday entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Well, Darren, I want to thank you for your time today. We're going to just wrap up. But before we do, I had just one last thing that I was hoping that you could share with us quickly. One, I'm going to ask you to tell us, one, how everybody can find out more about Sona Nanotech. And then the other thing I wanted to, when we had talked previously, you had mentioned some volunteer work and causes that you're passionate mm-hmm. about. So I wonder if you wanted to mention some of those as well.
Yeah, sure. As with most companies nowadays, social media is probably the easiest and quickest way to reach us. So not only we've got our webpage, which is www.sonanano.com, but also we're on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, etc., under the hashtags like @SonaNanotech, etc. So you can reach the company there. And then also, if people want to reach out and connect with me, then feel free to do so. Connections on LinkedIn are wide open. I'm this type of person who's happy to share networks and connections with people. So you just reach out to me on LinkedIn for a connection, by all means. It's Darren Rolls. And then I'm also quite a little bit active on Twitter and Sona_CSO. You know, which are, you know, typically industry-based tweets and kind of sharing, etc. So that's how you connect with us. I mean, regarding some of the other kind of community-based stuff I've been involved in, again, it kind of goes back to this, the whole thing around entrepreneurship, around doing different things, trying to get engaged. My previous company, we didn't really have a corporate social responsibility kind of area and areas of work. So we got involved with, you know, local projects. We started doing a thing called, it was called a Give and Gain Day, where basically I was able to convince my bosses to give the whole department essentially a day off, which was a Friday, to go and do local work in the community. You know, so we ended up raising some capital with local businesses who provided materials, et cetera. And we basically decked out a local school with a brand new playground. It was an inner city school, so they didn't have any green space. So we essentially made green space within the walls of their school. And we had the whole team that was part of my group come together for a day. But even prior to that, they spent a few weeks and, you know, kind of doing that work. And I see a lot of that kind of stuff does go on here in Atlantic Canada. I think it's built into the ecosystem, which is fantastic. But it was quite a new thing, certainly in the UK, to be doing through private companies. So again, it was just kind of looking at those types of opportunities. So we built that, and I'd like to kind of continue doing those things here, certainly in Atlantic Canada. There's certainly a lot of opportunities, you know, post-COVID to allow that to happen, which is great. Alongside that, as part of doing the MBA, I got exposed to a group called the Grow Movement, who basically use Western business leaders to help mentor and facilitate small new startup businesses in different countries in Africa. So Mali and Tanzania were some of the original countries. And they continue to expand into Uganda, etc. So we would do kind of, you get partnered with an entrepreneur in those countries, and we do Skype calls and kind of just talk them through their business and learn about their business and see what problems they were having, or if they had a particular area of interest that they wanted to learn more about. And you could just help and advise and mentor them. They would be doing all the work and you'd just be there, as I say, acting as a bit of a coach and a mentor. And it was really interesting. I got involved with a lady who was, she had a hairdressing company, and she was selling handbags with her sister out of that hairdressing company as well. And they wanted to expand, and we were trying to work out ways on how they can streamline that. So that was a really interesting project. Another one was he was producing music, and he wanted to know how he could expand his distribution around that in the local area. And it was really, really interesting, some of the side projects that we did. with a view to allowing them to expand their businesses, make more money, provide local jobs, etc. So that was a really exciting project.
So I said that was my last question, but I actually have another question that I know people are very curious about this one as well. So I apologize. I got just one last question, which is, if you were not doing what you're doing now, what would you do if you weren't being kind of a CEO entrepreneur? Like, what else would you want to do?
I'll probably lie on a beach somewhere, nice and warm.
That's a good idea too.
retired maybe. I don't know. I think I'd probably, a progressive next level. I feel sometimes with CEOs and entrepreneurs is always. I built something. I've created something new. How can I help others do that? I'm kind of in that mindset already. In terms of not one taking over the other, but working alongside it and saying, I'm doing this. I've learned all this knowledge and experience from doing it and the pitfalls. How can I translate that? How can I help other people doing it? And there's other groups that I'm involved in that forging ideas around maybe listing publicly on a publicly listed forum to be able to go and raise capital, for example, and I'm able to say, hey, look, take care of this, take care of that, make sure you do this, make sure you do that, just as an advisory thing. So I think I'd probably end up, if I wasn't doing this full time, running businesses, I'd probably be a coach, a mentor. As I mentioned, I've got a passion around education. So, and people have always said to me, and certainly my wife's always said to me, if you weren't a scientist, you'd probably be a teacher and you'd make a great one. I think I might want to do that in the future at some point. I still look at myself as quite a young guy. So I've got hopefully maybe in 10, 15 years. And I think I'd want to teach. If I was going to be a teacher, I'd probably want to teach either, university kind of college students, ones that are wanting to be there, have minds that you can help mold, or probably much more appealing is, just a bunch of kindergarten kids and you just get to play all day. So, how much more fun can that be?
That sounds fun. I see a lot of paint and glitter and science projects and volcanoes.
That's just like my house on a weekend.
I think I'm going to have to come over. I feel like that would be fun. Well, health restrictions.
We got a big yard.
Yeah, all that stuff. So, Darren, I really appreciate your time. You spent a good amount of time with us. I'm so excited to learn more about Sona Nanotech, and we'll make sure that everybody knows how to reach you and learn more about your company and all the great things you're doing. Want to really commend you for all of the things that you're doing yourself and with your company and helping us to address what's going on with the pandemic and COVID and all of the other avenues that you're pursuing with Sona Nanotech. And just wanted to say thank you for that. To all of our Onside podcast listeners that are out there, appreciate you listening, supporting our podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, which is at Onside Now. We look forward to having you again listening in on our next podcast. So thank you very much for all your time today.